Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guests today are Mike Maloney and Peter Thomas Fornatale. Mike lives in Lexington, Kentucky, and is a professional horse bettor. Peter is a Daily Racing Form tournament editor and the host of the Daily Racing Form Players Broadcast. Together, they have written a book, Betting with an Edge. Sounds like a perfect match for this show. This is a horse player's life in thoroughbred racing. Guys, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
I'm a big fan of the show, guys, and it's really exciting to be making my maiden voyage as a guest.
All right. So our listeners can figure out who's who. We're going to ask Mike a question first. So this is basically the story about how you became a winning horse player, as the book is also a primer for bettors trying to gain an edge at the track. How did the book come about?
Well, I always wanted to write a book, and I had been taking notes for years, and I thought I had some useful ideas for horse players. I also wanted to honor my dad and document our life together at the track. Dad was an everyday horse player who sat in my office beside me until he passed at 87 years old. So I wanted to talk about our life in racing. And Pete and I had a discussion around 10 years ago about possibly writing the book. And he stayed after me. And horse player's life is kind of a busy life, as most gamblers' lives are, I guess. And eventually he wore me down and we wrote it.
So, Mike, your father, I gather, he was a winning player, so you grew up sort of having a model of someone. You knew that the game could be beat, right? And how did he just pass along his methods, and that's how you got started?
It was actually a little different than that. Dad was a very good handicapper. He was known around the tracks in Kentucky for being a guy that would come up with some unbelievable long shots at times that would win. But Dad wasn't the best bettor in the world. So, my early life at the track was watching my dad make an amazing pick and then seeing him often find a way not to convert that into the cash that he should have, so, or that he could have possibly. So it was different. Dad always, Dad hit some huge bets, but Dad was, he liked his action and, he had winning years and he had plenty of losing years. So, I learned a lot from Dad, but I also learned a lot from Dad and his friends, things that I thought I could improve on.
And how did you end up finding yourself to be a winning player? I mean, how did that progression happen?
Well, it took a long time. I made my first trip to the track at 7 or 8 years old. I was getting thrown out of class in high school by the time I was 16 for reading the racing form in class. So I was handicapping fairly seriously by high school years. And I would hit in my 20s and early 30s. I was like Dad. I would make some huge hits. Even writing the book about an early pick six that I hit. But I also found a way to give it back. And I followed the path of most horse players for the first 20 years. But I wanted to learn, and I really tried to read everything I could get my hands on. I talked to everyone that would talk to me about racing and handicapping. And eventually, in my mid-30s, I began to hold my own. And then shortly after that, I began to make profits at the track. So, but it's always, even today, it's not a smooth, it's not like clipping coupons. It's a street fight sometimes to make money at the track.
Now, tracks take out about 20% of the input, and sometimes it goes much higher on the exotics, which sometimes are your specialty. That's a lot of house edge to overcome. How can you do that without computers?
Well, I use computers. I'm not a computer guy by any means, but I do use computers to manage the database. But I try to use my handicapping skills that I've developed over the years. When I was a young man, I spent a year on the backside, walking hots and doing a little grooming and owned a lot of cheap horses, claiming horses, throughout the years. So I think I have a better understanding than most horse players of the nuts and bolts of what goes on in the barn and how trainers think.
Can you explain what walking hots is?
Oh, walking hots is just when horses come back from their morning exercise or even from an official workout. They're hot. They're just like us after we've taken a run. And you'll give the horse a bath, blade him off to get the loose water off, and then walking for 30, 40 minutes just to let him gradually cool out. So it's just something we do every morning with each horse.
So you were working at the track with the horses, and that allowed you to pick the brains of the trainers and the other people there at the track.
Yes, and so how that relates in my handicapping is just, I call it reading between the lines. And that's not all I do, but when I'm evaluating a horse or when I'm handicapping a race, I'm looking at it not only from a numbers perspective, but I'm looking at it from a physicality of the horse perspective, from a progression of the horse perspective and I'm taking into account pedigrees. I'm taking into account what I know about the owners and trainers involved. Some trainers and owners will bring horses along much more quickly than other trainers. So, things like that aren't always, sometimes they're reliable. So most of my competition is all about the numbers, the probabilities, a lot of statistical probability involved. And I use that also, but I try to go beyond that and, have some other tools in my box to help me.
Okay, Peter Fornatale, so far you've just been a pretty face on the radio. How did you come across Mike?
Many moons ago, I was working on my first racing book. It was actually my first interaction with my friends at the Daily Racing Forum, for whom I would go on to work. I pitched a book called Six Secrets of Successful Bettors. I won't lie, in some ways it was influenced by a book, little book called Gambling Wizards that I had read. And the idea was to locate successful gamblers, particularly horse players, and attempt to distill their wisdom into actionable bites for the horse player. I had a co-author in this book as well, I should mention, a guy named Frank Scatoni. Well, I met many, many interesting players, and I don't like to pick a favorite, but I will say there was this one guy in Lexington, Kentucky, with whom I spoke, who was a professional horse player. He was shy at the time. He didn't want to use his name for the book. We just called him the Kentucky Player. And I found myself during the editing of the book going back again and again to the Kentucky Player's quotes and thinking, wow, there is so much stuff here. This guy should really do a book of his own. The Kentucky Player, of course, none other than Mike Maloney. So once I got that idea in my head, it was, as Mike said, I would call him about twice a year, and it was always fun to talk to him and hear how he was doing, and always fun to talk racing. But in the back of my mind, I had an ulterior motive, and the ulterior motive turned out to be this book that you hold in your hands now, Betting with an Edge.
Computer-assisted wagering came into the U.S. in the late 90s. How did that affect your ability to make money?
Oh, it made my life much harder. Those guys are very good. And it gets harder all the time. So some of the things that I described in the last question, things that aren't easily quantifiable are things that I have to continue to develop those angles in order to compete, you know, in today's environment.
Yeah. And you know, just going back for a second, at some point you realized you were a winning player and sort of quit doing any other kind of job and just started betting horses full time as your income, correct? And how long?
Yes, in the year 2000, I did that. I was formerly in the antiques business, so you don't hear that combination. Usually, the guy's been a commodities trader or a futures trader or something, you know, something like that. But I was a small businessman. My dad, I followed dad in a lot of ways. That was his business, and you know, we just ran a small business for years. It's actually maybe an interesting story. I was married at the time with children, and simulcasting was becoming, you know, more and more available in the late 90s, mid to late 90s. It got to the point where you could bet virtually any track around the country at one at your local simulcast parlor, and then, you know, also on the internet. So, yeah, I saw the opportunity there to transform into a full-time horse player. And when I discussed it with my wife, you know, understandably, she was a little hesitant. So we made we came to the understanding that I would bet the horses. I would keep the business and run the business, and I would bet the horses for 2 years, in addition to running the business. And we would do that in a separate account. And then we would look at my results after 2 years and make a joint decision as to whether to close the business and go into betting horses. Well, you know, fortunately, I did well enough those 2 years where she was comfortable with making that change. And in the book, I think we say, so we stepped into the great unknown together.
Your former business of antiques, I actually see a parallel between that and horse racing. To be a good antique dealer, you have to be able to look at something and evaluate it and see things in it that most people can't see. In horses, some people can look at a horse and get a whole lot of information just at a glance, where others have no chance at doing that. So I would think those skills have a bit in common.
I think that's an interesting observation. I would agree with you. Also, I was kind of a wholesale antique dealer, so I moved things very quickly and had a tremendous turnover in my business. So I spent a lot of times at auctions and with in import houses in Manhattan, and so I made a lot of rapid fire decisions every day, and I think that experience has helped me definitely in being a professional horse player.
So you talk one of the things you talk a lot about in the book is track bias, and can you explain a little bit about that and how you handle doing that at multiple tracks at the same time?
Well, first of all, track bias, just so I'm sure everyone knows, is just the idea that one part of the track may be favorable on a certain day or during a certain race, or a particular running style may be favorable during a certain race. In for example, maybe speed is holding very well this day. Maybe 8 out of 9 winners was the horse that made the early lead, which would be a very strong bias. But you know, I've seen that happen multiple times. So that's what we're looking for, is we're looking for horses that are advantaged or disadvantaged by the way the racetrack is playing. In order to do that and keep track of multiple tracks, I'm sitting in my office now, and there are 11 television screens, flat screens on the wall. And, you know, of course, I can't watch all of those at the same time, but the races are generally staggered. And as you know, so be one race, but usually not more than two running at the same time. And I have enough experience watching races now to where a lot of times I can just see part of a race. I can see 30 seconds of a race and determine if there was a bias in place. And you know, so it's not something I have to spend. It sounds like it nearly impossible task, but in practice, it's doable.
Yeah, I just want to point out for our listeners that unlike say a bias roulette wheel, where if it has a bias, it's the same bias all the time at a track. These biases change day to day, or sometimes, you know, halfway through the race meet, right?
Sometimes halfway through the race card. So lots of days. And this is, it didn't used to be this way very much 10 or 20 years ago. But in the last, the 6 or 8 years, the biases they'll change a lot more often during a single racing card at the same track. So I think it's the track supers are more informed now about bias, and they know how to address it. Like, for instance, put out the water trucks, and you know, if a track's kind of dry and the horses aren't handling the outside of the track as well as the inside, it's easy for the supers to send out the watering trucks, and then the bias can disappear or it can change to a different bias. So it gets very hard sometimes. I say in the book that if you're going to play the bias game, you best do so on your toes. And that's very true in real life.
Now, in Kentucky, I don't know if they talk about mapping routes or mapping routes, but however they say it there, what is it?
Well, I think we call it trip handicapping. At least that's what I call it. I assume we're talking about charting the path that the horses run in. For example, three paths from the rail or four paths from the rail. And yes, I do that every day, multiple tracks. I learned that from the great books that Andy Beyer wrote in the 70s and 80s. He was, that was my manual for learning trip handicapping, was reading Beyer's books.
And can you explain a little bit about what you're looking for when you, so you're looking at replays of the race and where each horse ran?
Yes, I do it sometimes from replays. I also do it while the race is running live. So the reason I do it that way, I've been doing it long enough where I can get most of the trips in a race, even in a 10 or 12 horse field, I can get most of those trips live. And the reason I do it that way is that helps me to find bias situations. By tripping the races, I can go back and say, well, the 9 and the 11 both outran their expectations in that race. The 9 and the 11 were the only horses that were in the four path. The horses that ran on the rail underperformed. So that might lead me to think that the track was biased in favor of outside runners. So now I might be able to act on it in real time, i.e. bet the next race at that track and lean toward the outside horses. I've already handicapped the race, but then I will adjust my betting strategy according to a perceived bias that I think is there.
In addition to that, if a horse underperformed, you know that for future races that maybe he's better than he looked in that particular race because he was in a bad spot.
Exactly. But I love to bet biased tracks, and I love to bet horses that are exiting races on biased tracks because it just creates opportunity. If every racetrack was completely fair every day, I think I could still do okay handicapping, but it would be much harder because a lot of the really prime bets that I come up with are bias or pace related.
Is there a pattern to the tracks that are more biased? Are the bigger tracks less biased, or is there some way to focus on any particular type of track that might lead to more bias?
There are tracks that have certain tendencies. So I keep what I call a biased book. It's just a little binder that every year I will fill in each date and each track that was running and what the bias was. And most people would do that on a spreadsheet, I'm aware, in 2018. But I'll leaf back through those books. And as a meet is getting ready to start, and just kind of refresh myself on what I've seen happen in the past, and what the tendency of that track is. And we as horse players, you know, we kind of know what the tendencies are at most of the racetracks that we play. But you still have to be very alert and aware. Yes, you'll see recurring biases, but some of the biggest opportunities in racing are when a track has a reputation, let's say as a speed track, and then you'll get a short-term closer bias on that track. Well, then, you know, you really, I guess I'm not a card counter, but I guess that would be where you would, you know, push your chips out in front of you. And, it's definitely what I do on my end at that point, because it's, you know, basically I know the odds are in my favor. That doesn't mean I'm going to cash that particular bet, and I can still lose three or four bets in a row in a scenario like that. But I know that in the long run, that's when I need to be betting at my highest level.
Sure. That's what we all do as professional gamblers, is just try to bet with the edge. And yeah, you're not going to win
right
every bet, but as long as you're always betting with an edge, you're going to, in the long run, be a winner.
Now, large players get rebates on their action. How much action do you have to bet to get the rebate? And what size rebate could you expect?
All that's changed in the last 6 or 8 years. Now, even very small players, like players of basically any amount, can get a 1 or 2% rebate just by signing up with an ADW, an advanced deposit wagering site. If you go beyond that and get up to say $100,000 a year, you can improve those rebates, obviously. But the breaking point is kind of betting $1 million a year. If players that will bet $1 million a year will get, you know, somewhere in the 10% rebate range, and it depends on the takeout in that on that particular bet at that particular track, but it'll average out somewhere around it. The important thing to me is what the net cost of a wager is, and if you're betting $1 million a year, your net cost of a way or more, your net cost of a wager is somewhere in the neighborhood of 12%. So that's still a pretty big nut to overcome. You know, it's compared to other gambling games, that's a pretty steep price.
It is.
Peter, handles at the U.S. tracks had been falling for years, but I recently read that they've started to go up again. Why do you think they were declining so much, and why do you think now they've started to turn around?
Well, I think the cost of making a wager that Mike was talking about is definitely the reason why those numbers were going down for years. I mean, just Mike talks in the book. I don't think I'm talking out of school here, because he talks in the book about how much less he's betting now than he was at his peak. And that all comes down to the cost of making a wager. Horse racing faces more competition than ever before in terms of that competition for the gambling dollar. And yet its response to this competition has been to raise its prices. That's obviously kind of insane and going to have a deleterious effect on the amount of money not only that you handle, but on the amount of money that you're going to make. There's a lot of different political reasons why very often tracks will put the next quarter over what's going to happen over the course of the next 2 years. And we've seen that fail time and time again. Finally, the tide is beginning to turn a little bit with not just pro horse players like Mike coming out and saying these things, but even racetrack executives getting up at industry meetings and talking about how the cost of making a bet and the takeout are too high. I believe, Richard, you're probably referring to some articles you've seen about the change in the tax law that happened late last year that has led to a little bit of a spike in the last quarter. Basically, for many years, horse racing, and I'll let Mike speak to this because he can do it far more eloquently than I can and accurately, but for many years, horse players were operating under tax laws that really choked down their liquidity and made it very hard to operate like businesses. Due to some hard-fought changes, which Mike was actually part of originating, one of the players back 10 or 15 years ago who helped start these efforts of an industry organization called the NTRA by sharing his tax returns and showing the exact effect that these draconian tax laws had. And they were just removed. And it's definitely allowed money to flow a little more freely. Am I describing that somewhat accurately, Mike?
Absolutely, Pete. The basically what the change that was made was that the IRS, in a ridiculous manner, in my opinion, used to only a wager had to pay 300-1 in order for reporting to kick in, IRS reporting. But if you bet $2,000 on a single ticket, they just looked at the $1 wager. If you bet 2,000 combinations, $2,001 combinations on a single ticket, the IRS looked at the $1 base amount. And even though there's $2,000 bet on a single ticket, if the ticket paid $600, it was a reporting situation. If the ticket paid $5,000 or more, it was a withholding situation. So I had multiple situations over the years where I would make a $6,000 play into a pick six or into a superfecta and hit for $5,000, lose $1,000 and have to pay 31% withholding on the $5,000 that I cashed for. So it was very unfair, and it hurt racing in that it stifled the churn. Horse players, their funds would dry up, and right before the tax refunds came back every year. So it was a welcome change to get this and now that I should explain that better. Now the IRS still has the 300-1 thresholds, but they take into account the actual cost of a ticket. So in my $2,000 example, the bet would have to pay 300 times your $2,000 base bet in order to be a taxable event.
Right. Well, that certainly helps. I mean, the other thing I think is that the racing industry has done a horrible job of marketing itself. If you go to Hong Kong or Japan and go to the track, it's full of young people. But you go here and, it's all guys over 60, I think.
I get to feel young at the racetrack. There are some exceptions, Richard, but they're very limited. The Keeneland Live meets, Del Mar in Southern California, occasionally Santa Anita on its big days, Saratoga, obviously. But I do think there's more that could be done in terms of enfranchising a younger crowd. And it's something that, unfortunately, racing has struggled with, and it's something that is going to have to be solved for the future health of the game. Racing has the opportunity to really succeed as a sport and to really succeed as a gambling game, but too often it falls somewhere in the middle, achieving neither of those goals.
Years ago, one of my favorite movies was The Sting, which involved a horse race where there was pass posting, meaning making a bet after the result bet after the result was known. Does that happen anymore?
Well, I'll take that one since that's my one of my pet peeves. Yes, it happens. It happens because our tote system in racing is woefully outdated, and that's not just my opinion, but every expert the industry has brought in at their own expense has said the same thing. The IBM came in and took a look at it a few years ago and said that it was laughable, obsolete, outdated, words like that, and recommended that it be replaced with a totally new system. That hasn't happened because, unfortunately, in racing, we are governed state by state by state racing commissions. So I think we have 37 different racing states. That's close anyway. And each one of those little fiefdoms has their own set of rules, and there is no national regulatory body that can tell all the tracks, hey, get together and bring this tote system up to date. Until that happens, these large corporations that are the main ownership groups of the tracks are not going to spend money that they're not forced to spend.
Actually, that was you, Mike, wasn't it, that had the interesting story about proving to them that pass posting was going on? And then when you showed them the evidence, they blamed you for pass posting?
Well, yeah, that's kind of the way it went down. And it's been a while ago, but I've been involved with it, you know, basically my adult life. But in 2007, the racing, even though there was pass posting on many, many races, betting after the race had begun. And in many cases, betting after the race was over. I document in the book about a graded stakes race at Hollywood Park a few years ago, not that many years ago, around 2010 or so, where the race was over. The horse was in the winner's circle. The running numbers were posted on the infield tote board. The race wasn't official because they were having a tote issue, but the first, second, third, fourth finishers were posted on the tote board, and the horses are ready to go back to the barn, and you could still bet. And the California Racing Commission admitted to that. So it's maddening, you know, if you're trying to do this for a living. But in 2007, the racing industry had not admitted to that point, even though this went on every day, that it ever happened. And, how can something be fixed until the people in charge actually acknowledge that it happens? So that was my task, was to force them to just say, hey, yes, it happened. So I detail in the book how I went about that, but it wasn't as simple as it would seem. I had to sync clocks at a racetrack to a signal on closed circuit television and simulcast feed, and it got very complicated. But bottom line, I got it done and documented that I had pass posted a race at Fairgrounds in 2007, and then got instead of thank you, here's a free ball cap and a t-shirt, I got disparaged in the press. The Churchill Downs came and tried to take my owner's license. I was a licensed owner in Kentucky and Louisiana and several other states, and they challenged that I shouldn't be an owner anymore, and which they failed in that challenge. And also the investigative bodies in racing, which there is only one really, it's the Thoroughbred Racing Protection Bureau. They're charged with overseeing the races and the betting and make sure everything's on the up and up. Well, they did, I think they spent their time investigating me rather than investigating what actually happened. And then I found out through my research that this investigative body is wholly funded by the racetracks. So I don't think that's the way oversight is supposed to be set up. But anyway, we got the industry to admit that pass posting had occurred. And since then, they dealt with it in some minor ways. But even after we had a fix six scandal at the Breeders' Cup in 2002, where a group of Toad employees basically stole the pick six pool, $3 million plus. They ended up getting caught through their own stupidity in the end. But, it's well known among players that have been around for a while how outdated the tote system is and how much, how it invites larceny in the wagering pool. So, it's a big problem for racing and it's not addressed.
You know, there's always talk about the fixing of races. Do you think that happens much in the U.S.?
I think on the rare occasion it can still happen, but that's not a major issue for me. That's, you'll hear about it from time to time, but, I feel like I'm getting shorted by the tote system a lot more often than I am by a fixed race.
Yeah, it's hard to believe that if this pass posting in the tote system was so bad that you could still bet with an edge.
It's funny. If you ask most racetrack execs, they would say, if you ask them the question, who has a higher level of integrity, the casinos or the racetracks? Toward in the regard to the wagering, I think almost every racetrack exec would claim that they do, that they have the higher level of integrity. But I don't know a great deal about Vegas, but maybe you guys can give me the answer on this. But it would occur to me that I make the analogy in the book about pass posting in thoroughbred racing versus keno in Las Vegas, and I say if just occasionally a couple of the balls in keno were able to be seen by some of the players and that were found out, that the gaming board would shut down keno and they would require that keno would have to be tested and evaluated before it could be brought back up online for Vegas wagering. And yet in thoroughbred racing, this has been proven to them for a decade now that this problem exists, and they've admitted to it, and yet the tainted wagering goes on uninterrupted.
And the reason is basically the track doesn't care too much who wins, but the track gets its cut by the total handle. So if they keep taking bets, the track's going to make more money, and so let's do it.
Well, there are tracks that are very honest out, and Keeneland is a track that comes to mind. I know a lot of those people, and I hold them in the highest regard. But there are also tracks out there that I don't hold in such high regard, and. If you're running a gambling game, in my eyes, job number one is to secure the money and make sure the game is fair and make sure the money is distributed properly. And I think there are instances in racing where that is not done.
All right. Are there other areas in the racing industry where that should be done? Things should be done to improve things, or is this the major area?
I'll chime in on that one.
Yeah, go ahead, Pete. Sorry.
I got a quick one on there, and it just has to do. It's like I think that the listeners to this show will be interested in because it's so different. Data in horse racing is super expensive. It's not. You don't have freely available data that allows creative people to craft apps and other tools that help them with their betting. It's the data is held under lock and key and super expensive. And it's something that I think hurts the overall development and growth of the sport because it's such an investment. If you are a finance type and you want to get involved and try your computer modeling skills in horse racing, the barrier to entry is just so much higher than it is in other gambling games. And I think as we continue to move towards the very civilized idea of legal gambling in a lot of states, it's an area racing needs to look at because it's just another way we have the potential to fall behind other gambling games. And, you know, I don't know how one would do it, but if you could sort of start again with horse racing, you know, thing number one you'd probably do is work on those financial terms that we were talking about that aren't competitive with other gambling games. But I think also coming up with a way to free the data would really promote growth, especially among a younger set of people.
If you freed all this data, would that make Mike's job harder or easier?
That's a good question. I'll let him answer that one.
I don't think it would have any impact on me, just the freeing up of the data. I wholly agree with what Pete's saying there. One thing I would add to it is that the data in racing is a lot of times is inaccurate. So, you know, they can't even keep track of exactly when a horse is gelded. You know, is he racing as a first time gelding? I work behind the scenes to get that reported. And then even when they agree to report it, they report it in a way that you don't really know. It sounds confusing, but it's one entity blaming another entity. And then you still don't know the data is not complete. Timing of races is woefully inadequate at large tracks like Gulfstream Park. The timing on the turf courses at Gulfstream Park is an absolute farce. And, you know, what should happen is Gulfstream Park should have enough concern about their customers who deal with that every day. I mean, when you're looking at the time of a race in betting horses, that's a very important piece of data. If you can't trust that, it's hard to wager. But Gulfstream Park chooses not to address that concern and fix it. So the Florida Racing Commission, Florida Gaming Commission, in my opinion, they license Florida Racing, they license Gulfstream Park. It falls on them to require Gulfstream Park to provide accurate data, to time their races correctly if they're going to accept hundreds of millions of dollars of wagering on them. But this is not done because most of the state racing commissions are heavily influenced by the bigger tracks within that state. So it's a catch-22 situation.
Now, Peter, you work for the Daily Racing Form. It seems to me like the major purpose of the Daily Racing Form is to publish data. Maybe I'm wrong. Is that true?
I see it as the paper of record for horse racing as would be, you know, it would be like job one in 1A. The past performances are obviously a huge part of what somebody's paying for when they pay for DRF. But I do think that the reporters of which I am not. I mean, I'm more of a guy on the marketing side. I do some reporting about horse racing tournaments, as you mentioned up top, and I host a podcast, but the real reporters at tracks across the country for DRF do an amazing job, and that's definitely part of the raison d'etre as well. But we don't own the data. We license the data the same as other people using data in racing through the jockey club, essentially, and a company that they own. So it's not I'm not coming on here putting my employers on blast, if that's what you're asking, Bob.
No, I'm definitely not asking you to go out and have to find a new job. So while Peter's worrying about his financial security, let's take a few minutes for a commercial break. and we'll be right back talking to Mike and Peter. The South Point has more than 10,000 games, returning more than 99%. This is more than anyone else has. In January, Monday through Thursday, 3 a.m. to 2:59 a.m., is the $500,000 spend to win promotion. Earn 500 slot points or 2,000 video poker points, and you can spin a virtual wheel right at your machine. Prizes are all points from $2,500. I wish. Prizes are points from 2,500 points, which is worth $750, through 100,000 points, which is worth $300. Or they can be in free play from $5 to $100. You may earn up to 4 spins a day. Throughout the first 2 weeks of the promotion, the spins have been averaging about 0.6%. This week, they appear to be going higher than that, based on a pretty small sample. The third week of free video poker classes on Tuesday, January 23rd, beginning at noon at the Silverado Lounge, is a game I've never taught before. It's 9-6, double-double bonus, quick quads, wheel poker. For quick quads, you pay an extra coin per line, and for hands like 9-9-9-5-4, where the smaller two cards add up to the rank of the three of a kind, you get paid for four of a kind, which is called a quick quad. For wheel poker, you pay an extra coin per line, and every time you get a four of a kind, or in this case a quick quad, you get to spin a wheel at your machine. It makes for a high-paying game with a unique strategy. Because the strategy is a bit complicated, there's only time for one class, and it'll be taught at the intermediate level. If you've had any other Bob Dancer classes, or are pretty familiar with using a reputable strategy and not just one you figured out yourself, you can probably keep up. If you're new to video poker, the class will probably be too complicated. If you're not sure, you're welcome to come and see for yourself. And leave early if you're just totally lost. The classes are free, and if you're old enough, you're invited. The Silverado Lounge is immediately in front of Don Vito's Italian restaurant. At videopoker.com, it's the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the Gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get correction on most of the games. The game of the week is Ultimate X Bonus Streak. Like regular Ultimate X, Bonus Streak is a 10 coin per line game where you earn multipliers this hand and collect those multipliers next hand if you can score a paying combination on the same line. Unlike regular Ultimate X, on most games, Bonus Streak requires three of a kind or higher to earn a multiplier rather than merely jacks or better. In regular Ultimate X, about 3/4 of your multiplier come from jacks or better, or two pair. You're missing those on Bonus Streak. The flip side of this is that when you do get the multiplier on Bonus Streak, it sticks around for 2, 3, or more hands, and frequently gets bumped up to 12X. It averages out the same, more or less. But since different hands earn the multipliers, a completely different strategy is required. At the present time, there are not Ultimate X Bonus Streak strategies available to the public. That means you're going to have to create them for yourself. Maybe someday the Wizard of Oz will publish some, but it hasn't happened yet. Personally, I'm not capable of creating a strategy for this game by myself, so I'll be avoiding this game. But maybe you are capable. And if so, this might create an advantage for you where you're not competing with everybody else. All right, Mike and Peter, we've been talking to them about the new book called Betting with an Edge. Before we took the commercial break, Peter mentioned tournaments. In other types of gambling, video poker, blackjack, etc., tournament play is very different than regular play. So, Mike, do you enter tournaments, and how is that different than your normal grind?
Yes, I'll play very rarely. I'll play two or three weekends a year. The reason for that is not that I dislike tournaments. It's just that I have so much work to do with keeping my database up to date that if I take time a weekend for a tournament, it sets me behind and I have to pay the price to get caught up. So every time I play a tournament, I find I have the same emotions that when the tournament is over, whether I've done well or poorly, I want to follow those guys to the next weekend and compete with them again. So, but your competitive juices get flowing, and I can see how people get totally hooked into the handicapping tournament world. But it is different than my regular day when I do a tourney. It's much easier generally. I tend to do some of my regular grind in addition to the tournament that I'm playing in, which is not smart game theory from, just regarding the tournament, but it leaves me with a little less catch-up work to do later. So I normally do a little hybrid, mainly focused on the tournament, but also doing some live money bets on the side.
But is a strategy a lot different in a tournament? If you're not doing well early in the tournament, is this a situation where you start betting the long shots considerably more in a chance to catch up, whereas in a regular day, your daily score is not that particularly important. It's your annual score. But in a tournament, your daily score is very important. So I would think your strategy is a lot different.
Yes, it is a lot different. Excuse me?
I was going to just jump in and just throw out the idea, Mike. I think you'll agree with this, that in the tournament situation, Bob, as you were indicating, it's all about if you're not at the very top, the best players are going to typically be at the bottom. You can't really sort of middle your way through. Now, granted, horse racing is so high risk that it's not like you're ever really looking to middle your way through during a day of betting. But if that eventuality were to happen, you're certainly not going to do anything to force it in a different direction. As you pointed out, it's all about what your dollar is worth over a much longer period of time. Tournaments, and there are many different formats of tournaments. Some involve mythical money, a la, the World Series of Poker. You have a bankroll, but at the end of the day, if you're collecting, you're collecting from the prize pool only. Other tournaments are you're betting actual cash, and that will affect your strategy as well. But in any instance, I've noticed that the best players typically, if they're not at the top, they're at the bottom.
For players, for our listeners who are always interested in getting an edge, if they wanted to start to dip their toe into horse racing, what books or websites or what would you recommend, other than this book, of course, Betting with an Edge?
Well, Pete has a vast knowledge of the handicapping literature out there. For my two cents worth, I think even though they're from the 1970s, 80s, I still think Andy Beyer's books are very useful. They lay out a lot of basic handicapping principles that that I think are still work today, and they're very readable and entertaining books as well. But there is there's invaluable information in there. I just think I will reread a Beyer book after I take a break before I go back to my play. And the book that we mentioned earlier, The Six Secrets of Successful Bettors, that Pete and Frank Scatone did, that I was in, not just because I was in it, but I think I've reread that book several times because I just think there are so many good philosophies from different players that can lead you in the right direction.
In terms of absolute beginner books, for me, The Steve Davidowitz classic, Betting Thoroughbreds, was updated a couple of years ago by DRF Press. I put that on a reading list. A book by Brad Free, one of my colleagues at DRF as well, called Handicapping 101, is a great way to learn the basics, the fundamental principles of handicapping, as well as the basics of just how to read the racing form. You'll find that stuff in there. Mike's book, Betting with an Edge, is a step-by-step walkthrough of the process of handicapping and betting as well. But these days, I'd suggest that multimedia tools are very valuable. And at the risk of being a total company man, I say this only because I think the stuff is really good. DRF has a YouTube channel, drf.com/YouTube, and my colleagues Matt Bernier and Dan Illman and Mike Beer make videos about, they basically are previewing and reviewing every major stakes race. And I believe if you listen to those guys talk, you'll learn a lot about racing. And hey, while you're on that YouTube channel, if you want to check out the little podcast that I do with Jonathan Kinchin, we do sort of a similar process of previewing and reviewing. And, you know, after we spend so much time talking about the problems in racing, I do want to say, you know, there are still aspects even of cash gambling that I think are worth it for people who enjoy betting to check out. The intellectual challenge, the different steps that go involved into horse race betting are very stimulating and challenging for somebody with a gambling mindset. And the tournaments, to me, are definitely a growth opportunity and a way to pursue betting the horses in a controlled manner. So I wanted to just get that general plug for horse racing tournaments in there as well.
Now, if you could successfully handicap thoroughbreds, how long would it take you to become competent in handicapping quarter horses? Is it the same deal, or is it a totally different sport?
Well, I don't claim to be a quarter horse expert by any means at all. I'm not. But there are tracks I play. For example, Indiana Downs in Shelbyville, Indiana, their last race of the day will often be a quarter horse race. So there are multi-leg bets, pick threes, et cetera, that will include that race. So that's what initially got me to look at those races, because I wanted to participate in every pick three pool that I could, especially if I liked a horse or thoroughbred in one of the preceding races. And I found that, you know, that to some degree, horses are horses. So some of the same fitness and even bias techniques that I use with thoroughbreds worked with quarter horses. So, it's not like I'm ready to change over to quarter horses, but I've been surprised how much sense it's made to me when I have delved into that area.
And do you bet harness as well?
No, I don't. My office now is at the Red Mile, the historic harness track in Lexington. So I'm immersed in the standardbred world now. I have some guys in the offices down the hall here who are full-time harness wagerers. But I have enough trouble keeping up with the thoroughbred, so I'm making a conscious effort to not get distracted by the harness world.
All right. Before we let you go, Mike and Peter, is there anything you want our listeners to know about you? We're going to give them your Twitter handles, but other than that, anything else you want to tell our listeners before we let you go?
Well, if I could go first, I would like to. I know I have. I've said some negative things about the tote pools and the structure and ownership of racing. And I feel strongly that, you know, I stand by what I said. But I also want to say that I don't think there's a more fascinating gambling game on the face of the earth. And there are betting horses is, I'm a good example. I have spent my entire life, I'm 62 years old. And starting from age 15, I have immersed myself in trying to learn everything that I can learn about thoroughbred racing and handicapping. And I still run up on something new every day. So it is a tremendously fascinating game. And it's a very entertaining and mind challenging game to play as it is today. But I just always think of the unlimited potential that we would have if we cleaned up a few of our weak areas.
Before we let Peter go, but if they cleaned up those weak areas for you, they'd be also cleaning up those weak areas for all your competition. Would that really would make your...
No, that would be fine. I think, you know, but by cleaning up my weak areas, you know, by cleaning up the weaknesses in the game, I mean just integrity issues, some of the pricing issues, and I'm, you know, that, you know, just put, you kind of just put us back to where we were 10 years ago pricing-wise, which... The industry can obviously exist at that pricing structure. I think our handle would improve enough to where everyone in racing would make more money, the tracks included. But I'm willing to adjust to. I don't worry so much about my competition. I worry more about improving myself. And just, you know, being the best player that I can be. And I do have a love for the game. I've been around it my whole life. I've grown up in Lexington, Kentucky, which is a hotbed for thoroughbred racing. And, I love the game, and I just, it hurts me to see it not be the game that I know it can be.
Any final words from you, Peter?
Yeah, my thought for any advantage player types listening who are thinking about horse racing, I do think getting well-versed in the traditional handicapping methods and certainly betting strategy that Mike espouses in Betting with an Edge is a great place to start. But I also wouldn't rule out the idea of, you'll have to do a little bit more digging on this because there isn't a book about it. You'll be looking all over the internet for old papers. But the idea of trying to meld modern approaches of computing power and ways of crunching data meaningfully with a really smart old school horse players approach to try to take the conversation away from horse racing being a story about man versus machine and trying to make it a story of man plus machine. I think that's the future of advantage play in horse racing. And it wouldn't surprise me if somebody listening out there is going to pick up that baton and run with it. And I think that I think Mike's book, Betting with an Edge, could be a big piece of that.
All right. Thank you both. If you want to connect with Mike on Twitter, it's at Silk1900. And if you want to connect with Peter on Twitter, it is at LoomsBoldly, which is an ominous sounding Twitter handle, by the way.
A reference to the great Tom Durkin, a race caller who would bust that out at a particularly dramatic point on the turn in a race. And here's Coronado's Quest looming boldly at the eighth pole, that kind of thing.
Uh-huh. Well, for those of us totally outside of the sport, that reference was a mile over my head. So, but I'm glad it wasn't as ominous as I was fearing. Both these handles will be listed in the show notes. It can take a couple days for the show notes to catch up. If they're not there the first time you look at the podcast, check again in a couple days, and it will be. Thank you, Mike Maloney. Thank you, Peter Fornatale. Thank you, Richard. Good day, everybody, and go out and hit lots of royal flushes, even at the racetrack.